bonjour, and welcome back to Canucks a Slur, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name is Kelly, and my guest today is Tanner, who hopefully hasn't picked, of all things, the same podcast premise as me in a relatively small pool of recurring co-hosts. Tanner, what's your podcast about?
Well, you're going to be hearing from our lawyer very soon, who will tell you all about what our podcast is about. I am the real co-host of a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters called Beyond the Breakers. It is basically just a history podcast through a maritime lens.
Great. Well, nothing better to do than, you know, just maintain the same premise for 72 years and hope it doesn't become a problem.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is the only way to find out which one of us will truly win out, which has the more quality product, I guess.
Ah, fuck. Ah, shit.
Which one has the most spaces in our name?
You wouldn't believe where I have spaces in this. Speaking of team names, I had this thought while I was editing the last version. I've never really thought of this before, but if you were in charge of merging teams called the Tigers and the Wildcats, mm-hmm. would it not be more coherent to just say, like, okay, these are the Wild Tigers?
That would work.
I feel like that works so much better.
I mean, although by specifying they're the Wild Tigers, it implies that there could possibly be a team called, like, the In Captivity Tigers, which doesn't sound as intimidating.
I don't know. But you're not them. You are the Wild Tigers.
That's true. Like, you could do that. I think that would be nice.
I think you can't always take that logic to its fullest extent every time, because otherwise you're saying, like, well, the existence of the tiger cats implies the existence of the tiger dogs, or does it imply the existence of the wolf dogs?
The Sickos Committee on Blue Sky Twitter yesterday was discussing the concept of, like, opposite schools, and they're like, what school would be the most opposite from the Air Force Academy? And the best response was Colorado School of Mines.
Interesting. Do you think the Air Force kind of gets jealous of the Army Navy rivalry?
Absolutely. I mean, they are the odd one out, really, in it.
Or do they just kind of enjoy sitting on the sidelines every year going, ooh, they're playing without me. Ooh, I hate this.
But also, like, the Air Force is way out west. So, like, they're not even, like, geographically close to the other two. So they are kind of the younger sibling, doesn't really get as much respect. I mean, they are literally a lot younger than the other two branches.
I guess that makes sense, because what these literally refer to is a specific school, but it really just didn't land in my brain at all to be like, well, the Air Force is not located where the Army and Navy are. And I'm like, they're the whole country. What are you talking about? But yeah, no, I guess the actual academy has to be somewhere.
Right, exactly.
This is all just housekeeping from last time, but we kind of got sidetracked. I was literally in the process of telling you this. We were talking about weird team mergers, but I think you'll like this. So I think I mentioned this before. I used to play rugby union just as a youth, basically. Rugby union is not super popular in Canada. It's a real kind of friendly sideshow sport. Over whatever period of time, there's been mergers, I guess, in at least Edmonton area amateur rugby union clubs, because, you know, they struggle financially and they merge and stuff. The team that I played for, the group that I played for, I believe what happened was I played for the Druids, as far as I know.
That's a little problematic, I'd say.
Is it?
I maybe to someone, I don't know, not to me.
We're appropriating mage culture.
Are there any ancient Britons or Picts listening to this by chance?
You know, it doesn't. I'll have to check the RSS.com breakdowns for that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I believe what it was a team called the Druids that pretty much just subsumed a club called the Outlaws, which I feel like is the more tidy outcome you can get. Is just, yeah, okay, we're gonna go with our branding, because I think there were some Outlaws T-shirts at one point, but it was just everyone said Druids. All the signage seemed to say Druids. So
that's such a funny name to have for a team in a sport that's, like, a very physical sport, rather than, like, you're not winning the game through magic, surely.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you, as most rugby clubs do, choose your name out of a D&D class book, would you not go with the Barbarians?
Yeah, like, that would be something like that. You know, the Orcs would be kind of cool, I think.
I think somebody was trying to go for a sort of, I guess, vaguely Celtic vibe. I mean, it might have been founded by an actual
Druid.
Well, I was going to say an actual Welsh person, because I think literally the exact Welsh dragon is their logo, mm-hmm. or it's an incredibly similar dragon. And I think the decent amount of rugby clubs in North America were often just founded at some point by someone migrating who's like, I want to keep playing, but I don't know. That's speculation.
We were talking about the slurs like Scotch for Scottish and Welsh for Welsh. I think we could also, we could probably use Druid as a slur for a Welsh person also.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of kind of problematic ways to identify ethnic groups. So one of our, I think this was the hated rival team, as I understood, they were also the result of a merger. So this was the merger of a club called the Leprechauns and a club called, what else is a club going to be named?
Is it a racial slur?
No. The other common type, the other common type of rugby name.
Tigers?
The Tigers, yeah. So it was a merger of the Leprechaun Tigers. So again, you were probably just not going to be shocked to know they went with the most obvious branding possible.
The Tiger Cons.
The Leprechaun Tigers.
Oh, all right, cool.
Yeah. This tended to get shortened, like, oh, well, they're the LTs, but I think most often I remember calling them the Lep Tigers, and it kind of sounds like a tiger with a disease to me.
It does. Oh.
But I didn't really make that connection, but like, if there probably is a similar energy to naming your team the Druids, like name your team the Leprechauns is like, was one of you Irish when you founded this?
Are you allowed to use that?
But Leprechauns is like, at least a Druid is something that can conjure a sort of sense of, if not intimidation, but I don't know, like might or whatever it is you're trying to convey with a team name. The Leprechauns.
I think that with Druid, there's certainly a sense of uncertainty in the opponent. Who's like, I don't actually know what kind of abilities this person has. So,
yeah. I mean, I guess you could say the same thing about a Leprechaun, but.
That's true. I mean, there's the evil one, like from the movies. You could be those kinds of Leprechauns.
I haven't seen them. I really want to imagine the meetings where, you know, maybe like six people sat around like, what are we going to call? And there's one person who's like, Leprechauns, please. And it's like, we have to probably do whatever Darren wants because Darren's dad has the money, like he's putting up the money to fund this club.
Mm-hmm.
And then the money ran out. So the Leprechaun Tigers it was. But we have new material to record. So in part five, we skipped over some of the key developments that created both American and Canadian gridiron football. So to flesh that out, let's head back to the 1880s and finally learn about this guy, Walter Camp.
Mm.
Walter Camp, as I briefly indicated earlier, started playing football at Yale in 1875 and graduated in 1882. When he started, the school had been in the process of switching to rugby football, but had held out on joining that Intercollegiate Football Association because they still wanted the Eton-style 11-per-side numbers. Camp had actually been in attendance to watch the first ever Harvard-Yale match in which the former completely dominated the latter under a set of compromise rules in 1875. So that's just 1 year after Harvard had gotten the rugby game from McGill, and this is the year before he would begin to play himself.
Okay.
So this huge humiliation at the hands of Harvard was a factor in pushing Yale to join the IFA and submit to the evolving set of common rules, which they did in 1879. And they did get their way. The IFA reduced its teams to 11 players the next year. And this is the sort of thing you might see Camp credited with inventing, even though he clearly got the idea from his own school, who had in turn clearly gotten it from Eton. Walter Camp's own writing and the writing of his most ardent supporters is saturated with American exceptionalism and tries to position him like an American version of the mythical William Webb Ellis. In reality, he was more analogous to the real Tom Wills, and by that I mean a talented all-around athlete who was very successful in advocating for his side at the meetings where many people were all having the same discussions over what the rules should be. Another innovation frequently credited to Camp is the snapback, which manifests today as a player transferring the ball to someone behind them using their hands between their own legs. However, to better understand this shift, we can, again, look to what was more universal across football codes in this general time period. The two main themes at play were that offside was a nebulous, ever-changing concept that was often tremendously confusing, and scrums sucked and were unbelievably boring. Even Australian football, which today has no formations that resemble a scrum at all, faced this problem. One critic called scrummaging, quote, like so many hungry dogs struggling for the possession of a bone, end quote. And this little image I've given you here is, this is an early Australian football drawing?
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing something that would have been termed scrummaging. It is a hot mess of, it's a tangle of bodies trying to get a ball out.
Mm-hmm. This is like what I was picturing from The Hot in like episode 2 or 3 or whatever. This is exactly what I imagined.
Well, and honestly, that is basically what The Hot was. That's what all of these things were, is every description is just some variation of, it is just a tangle of people, and it's incredibly boring to watch and incredibly unpleasant to do. It just sucks on every level. This is a really common, I would say almost universal theme from the early eras of The Hot and The Bully and these school games through the end of the 19th century, when everyone's just saying, like, this is ass. Like, surely we could do something better than this. Because if anybody is familiar with what a scrum is, if you watch rugby union today, like, they're very orderly, they're very technical, and they have a clear purpose. Mm-hmm. Of trying to push the other team downfield and extract the ball out the back to your own team so that you can kind of do your fancy passing and move the ball out that way. This is absolutely in no way what any of that shit looked like before.
Yeah, like the one thing I remember from my little bit of watching rugby on TV is how actively the referees like police the scrum and are pointing out and telling players, hey, you got to do it this way, stop doing this. Which is kind of an interesting part of the game to watch. I don't know what the rules are, but it's fun to hear them talk about them.
But even on the player's end, like, the intention changes. So there's sort of an intermediary portion where I believe it's when Camp was playing, because he eventually advocates for this sort of snapback system. But even before that's in place, when they're doing more conventional scrummaging, there's still this sort of idea that I think we saw, especially in the Eton Bully, where the goal was actually to push it through the formation, like kick it past the other team behind them, because it's all about, I guess, field position, or like, even that's probably too generous in terms of strategy. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was arguably more strategic and innovative to even say, what if we tried pushing the ball out the back of this to our side? Mm-hmm. I think even in one of those proto games, it was illegal to do that.
Right. The bup and the bully, while formed, can bring the ball forward, but they cannot kick it back. If they do, it's called firking, and firking is an offense.
So going back to one of our preferred sources here, which is the book How Football Began by Tony Collins, as he's describing Australian football here, quote, as late as the 1890s, complaints were common that the game was dominated by scrums, end quote. Although he does write elsewhere that scrums had largely died out in their game by the 80s. But somewhere in that time, like, this is still an ongoing part of the debate, even in that game where you don't see scrums at all today. Mm. Back in Britain, scrums were being described as monotonous shoving matches, and in Canada as, quote, an exhibition of brute force by 30 men crushing and jamming in a surging mass, end quote.
Hell yeah. All of those things he just said, brackets, positive, question mark.
The streams of the sport that would go on to broadly remain in the rugby union camp would spend many decades evolving its scrums into the vastly superior and far more technical version you can watch today, and the emergence of rugby league further diminished the role of scrums in that code. This remains a fixture of debate to this day on both sides of the divide, with some organizations continuing to chip away at the presence of scrums in their games, such as the Australian NRL, who play the league version, did this as recently as 2020, and the American MLR, who play the union version as recently as 2025, still making moves to reduce or eliminate scrums from the game. But to get back to the 19th century, one piece of evidence that Canadian schools other than McGill were consistently playing some form of rugby-style game comes out of concurrent attempts to reform these rules. Again, from How Football Began.
Barely a year after the 1874 Harvard-McGill matches, Canadian players engaged in discussions about rugby reform, reflecting debates in British rugby that led to teams being cut from 20 to 15 players and obliged tackled players to release the ball. On the 16th of October 1875, a football convention was held at Rawson House Hotel in Toronto, at which representatives of 9 clubs discussed adopting a common set of rules for the game in Ontario and Quebec, the 2 most populous provinces of Canada. The meeting decided to adopt RFU rules, but 3 delegates, including those from McGill and University College Toronto, voted against, ensuring that the debate on football rules would continue.
This is off topic, but I just remembered this as you were saying Toronto again.
Toronto.
Well, hearkening back to the Toronto-Tirana thing. So the capital of Albania, which I was in recently, is...
Tirana?
Yeah, Tirana. I think to enunciate as clear as possible, Tirana. So I was in a hostel. I was in a different city, but I was talking with some Canadians, and you're like talking about, well, where are you from? I'm from Vancouver. I'm from Toronto. And as we were in Albania, other people were like, every time Canadians say Toronto here, like while I'm here, I get so confused mm-hmm. over which city you're talking about.
You're very clearly not.
Yeah, you are not from Toronto. Anyway, so yeah, no exaggeration in terms of the pronunciation there. So yeah, there was a majority there that wanted to just wholesale adopt these RFU rules, but McGill and University College Toronto are dissenting because they don't like scrums as they exist. The delegate from McGill was quoted as calling them monotonous, uninteresting, and dangerous, and further, a melee where no advantage results from precision, agility, or experience. Yeah, it's even attested that these schools were experimenting with open formations, which is stuff that looks a lot like what you see, basically what you would call the way you line up in gridiron football now. Mm-hmm. That is what is meant by open formation whenever that term comes up.
Okay.
It's basically an alternative to the scrum because the scrum sucks. Mm-hmm. And like this is something to bear in mind. It's easy to kind of do this this imagination of people are looking at the way rugby is played today and saying, no, we don't want that. We're going to invent gridiron football. And it's everyone hates this surging mass and rugby evolves in one direction, football or gridiron football evolves in another mm-hmm. direction and so on.
So in terms of legislating the scrum out of the game, how is that actually done mechanically? Is that done by like limiting how many players you can have in a certain space?
This is, I think, a misconception that happens sometimes. So like even last night, I was literally watching. So the division finals for the CFL were on last night. And there was some sort of thing that happened where like all these teams, this will happen still in gridiron football, where like somebody's trying to punch across a goal line or something. Everyone is all masked up together. Mm-hmm. And commentators will like describe this as, oh, it's like a scrum.
A
it's
scrum.
Like a rugby style
yeah.
scrum. They also, especially with CFL games, they'll be like, oh, it's like hearkening back to the days of rugby with this scrum. But what it literally is, if you're using rugby terminology, is a maul. A maul is something that comes up, like M-A-U-L. Mm-hmm. A maul is something that comes up organically where like the ball is held up and everyone grapples the person and is trying to push them in a direction and either there's rules to the mauls I can't even remember. But a scrum is like, it's like a face-off. It is
right.
always from a set point. And there's different times in the game where you can call a scrum. Mm-hmm. And there was at one point, I think this is one of the sticking points that leads to rugby league, the direction that moves in, is that they were setting up a scrum for every completed tackle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Even to like today, like in rugby union, just going off the top of my mind, there's different times where you can opt for a scrum or opt for something else. But yeah, to answer your question more directly, like a scrum is one way of restarting play.
Okay.
There's different ways to do it. Like there's throwing in from the sideline. There's like kicking off from certain areas. There's base. You can have these situations that are penalties essentially in rugby where like you can kick for a goal if you're close enough, but you can also just like tap it off your foot and keep running with it. Like mm-hmm. how often are we going to have scrums be the result of when play starts? And like a lot of people like today in rugby league just don't like scrums at all. They're like, this is so not conducive to our game. So finding other ways to restart plays, I guess, mm-hmm. is the
okay.
core answer to the question. Right. So these schools were apparently experimenting with different kinds of open formation instead of at the time what were conventional scrums. And this was before Walter Camp began proposing his version of the snapback in 1880. So the exact nature of these open formations and the extent to which people like Camp may have taken inspiration from them, because again, these are conversations that are happening in Canada. So was he noticing some of the stuff that was being experimented with? Were they just too different of a thing? It's just unfortunately not very clear. Mm. Even Tony Collins here admits there's a big lack of primary sources. And you have to add on to that, players at this time actually quite frequently played with a lack of regard for the written rules anyway.
I mean, I guess that's part of every era of sports to some extent.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really tracks back to when we first talked about what happened at rugby school, where the students would constantly break the rules and then discuss after if that rule breaking was interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's kind of hard to document. Is like you can document what you wrote down, but you don't necessarily document exactly when a player first broke this rule or when people began to consistently break this rule. Like it's just mm-hmm. nobody was thinking of future historians when they were doing this, right?
Mm-hmm.
One thing that Camp, as well as other American reformers, can take more credit for within the long-term evolution of the game is that they were able to get the major American schools to subscribe to the same code from this point forward. You compare that with Canadian football was being played under as many as four different sets of rules into the beginning of the 20th century. Even as late as 1905, there was a national championship played between the top teams of Ontario and Quebec, respectively, and in this, they each played half of the game under each side's preferred laws.
I would watch a game like that between, like, you could have, like, a NFL versus CFL tournament.
There have been attempts to do things like that. We'll probably cover this with trivia later, but I believe there was a few examples in, like, the 50s or something of, like, exhibitions between NFL and CFL teams.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least American and Canadian teams.
Right.
At the time, the IFA was chugging along with more and more reforms. Scoring was one aspect that received a major overhaul. In the RFU's original 1871 rules, the word touchdown was used to describe the general process of pressing the ball down against the ground to indicate possession outside of the main playing area. This included balls that had gone out of bounds on the side. The first team to pull off this touchdown would be granted a throw-in from the sideline.
Mm.
If the touchdown happened in the opponent's goal area, however, the team would be granted a try at goal, the chance to kick it through the goalpost for a single point. Finally, you had a touchdown for safety in your own goal area, which permitted you to punt the ball out.
Mm.
You can see how these different things evolved, right?
So the initial touchdown in the opposing area is not worth any points on its own. It's just allowing you the chance to score points.
Yes. So that's why they call it a try at goal. And that's why today in rugby, it is still called a try.
Okay.
So yeah, like touchdown was very literal in that they had you touch down the ball with clear control of the ball, whether that was your end zone, the other team's end zone, or out of the sideline. So that's been kind of like, that doesn't exist on the sideline in any code today. Now it's usually whoever sends it out, like either the same team or the opposite team will get possession where it went out, which is a much more sensible way to do it.
And so, like, on the opposite end, you talk about the safety. So it sounded like from that description that that team would punt the ball, but that's not worth any points for the defense directly.
If I understand kind of these old rules correctly, if you were wrestling with somebody in either end zone, if you touch it, if the, like, attacking team touches it down, they get a try at goal, right? So you bring the ball out to a certain zone to kick from. But then if the defending team touches it down, then they get the safety, which means, okay, get out of my way. I'm going to punt this out.
Okay. That makes the term safety make much more sense.
Yeah, like they're all just shortenings of this thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, when you look at the original context, it makes so much more sense. Touching down is literally touching the ball down. So you have a touchdown for a try at goal or a touchdown for safety. And then different parts of the terms are lopped off over time.
And like I remember as a kid being confused by that when I was first learning about football, that like safety sounds like a good thing. Why would I not want to get a safety? And then, like, of course, if your team gives up a safety, that is a bad thing.
Yeah, at this time, it is explicitly good to touch the ball down. Like, if the ball is in your zone, getting that safety is good because it gives you the chance to punt it out.
Right.
One excellent example of why the scoring badly needed reforming is the Yale-Princeton game of 1877. By pre-game agreement, it was decided to use that kind of scheme in which only goals would be counted. So this is not necessarily even set in stone. The captains are getting together before the game and saying, okay, do you want to count touchdowns or not today?
It's like T-ball. It's like...
it's like... And this is, again, why it is sometimes hard to draw these clean narratives for the history, is that it could vary from game to game. It was just, what was the gentleman's agreement between the captains?
Mm-hmm.
And on this particular day, they said, we are only counting goals, that meaning kicked goals.
I'm still turning over the safety thing in my head, and it makes me kind of reconceptualize the whole thing in that, kind of knowing the origins, because like in the modern NFL, like if you get tackled for a safety in your own end zone, it's 2 points for the other team and you kick the ball to them. And so now thinking of that punt as originally the benefit you would derive from it as the defense, now it makes much more sense as you're basically spending 2 points to get the ball away from your end zone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, that seems to click much better now for like, how did the safety come about?
There is a direct process of iteration there. And like, this is jumping ahead a little bit, but Walter Camp is among the crowd of people, or to hear him tell it, the person who is going out there and saying, what if we make the safeties worth points?
Mm-hmm.
but then you're basically just adding the points to the existing rule. So Walter Camp himself is playing in this particular game, and he manages to run the ball in twice. The first is described as an 80-yard return on a punt that he caught, and the second was a 50-yard run in which he shook off several tacklers to get it and touch it down. In both cases, the ensuing kicks were missed. This game also featured a kick so deep that it went, as described by the New York Daily Herald at the time, quote, across Princeton's line, then behind carriages, end quote, with Yale players and their Princeton pursuers said to have, quote, scattered the lookers-on in their way as if they were reeds, end quote.
Just playing through.
Yeah, legitimately. I mean, you get little flavors of this with the teams on the sidelines today, especially in gridiron football.
Mm.
And like once in a while, you'll have somebody, you know, smoke like a camera operator.
Right.
But yeah, much more so the bystanders are right in it at this time. So that's the New York Daily Herald's version of it. The Boston Globe, they have reporting on the same game, and they phrase it as one of the Yale players, and that's actually Camp's mentor, Eugene Baker, kicking it, quote, into the crowd, and in rushing after it, knocked down a lady and a little girl, but captured the ball, end quote.
That's what it's all about.
And to be clear, both of those newspapers absolutely agree. They knocked down a woman and a little girl. or maybe like a teenager at best.
Mm-hmm.
Now, knocked down a lady and a little girl, but captured the ball. On the latter count, I believe they're mistaken because the New York publication here tells us more clearly.
Between two carriages, whose occupants looked with amazement at the tussling men, Princeton stopped Baker's progress very prettily. Then a dispute arose about the play, which ended in the men of Orange getting the best of the point in Yale's claim to a touchdown not recognized. Princeton was given the ball and, by excellent judgment, sent it out of their territory to the center of the field.
Right, so first off, just kind of triangulating these two different newspapers' descriptions,
mm-hmm.
It sounds like, I mean, there's probably nothing in the way of bleachers. So if you are affluent enough, you can like pull up your carriage to watch the game. And I guess just kind of anywhere around the edge of the field. Because my interpretation of this is he kicked it clean through the end zone. It landed in the space between carriages. And because end zones tended to have that, you know, the line goes infinitely and it's infinitely deep. It's like, all right, well, the ball's between the carriages. Like, let's go fight for it. And then they could just kind of look out the window and be like, yep. Sure is a capital competition.
That's almost like elements of like arena football, how like the walls are, you know, like half of a person's height. So players like pretty routinely go into the crowd. Or basketball. Everything's so close around the court on a basketball court.
Yeah, very much so. I wonder if there's any, if you keep looking, if there's any match reports where it's like, yeah, well, he ran clean into a wagon wheel and absolutely just snapped his arm or whatever. This is where I get this impression that basically at the same time, wrestling for, is this a touchdown for a try goal or a touchdown for safety based on which player essentially gets the pressure right on the ball down to the ground. So what happens here is, yeah, Yale's claiming, yeah, we got the touchdown, which means we get to kick for a point. But the people refereeing or the umpires at this point are saying, no, we're ruling in Princeton's favor. Mm-hmm. This is a touchdown for safety. And so they go, okay, well, we're just going to kick it the fuck out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So you add to that at least one called off touchdown for Princeton and two recorded touchdowns for safety by Yale in their own goal, plus five of these conceded by Princeton. You get a thrilling final score of
0-0.
0-0, yeah. The initial efforts to fix this entailed things like, okay, well, what if we count four touchdowns as equal to one goal and then two safeties is equal to one touchdown? But over the course of time between 1883 and 1885, by this point graduated Walter Camp has become a leading figure in getting everyone to agree to 5 points for a touchdown, one for converting the touchdown, three for a field goal, two for forcing a safety, which is very close to what you have today, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, by comparison, this kind of scoring reform doesn't even begin in rugby football in the UK for another 4 years. And they just continue to play with this, you know, try for goal, single point goal. And today, so again, for the non-sports people who don't know, rugby has very, very similar scoring, but slightly different. But the gridiron football had that down first.
Mm.
Another element of the game that proved problematic was possession. So initially, this attempt to liven up the game by breaking up the turgid scrummages, which they do by defining it as continuous possession for the team that gets tackled, it actually makes things worse. So the descriptions of that Princeton-Yale draw in 1877, yeah, it's 0-0, but the way people are reporting on this game, it's got kicking, it's got running, it's got tackling. Shit is happening.
Mm-hmm.
The same schools then play in 1881 to a 0-0 tie that was infamously awful to watch. So with control of the ball now guaranteed when the ball goes down, well, this is how it's described in a biography of Walter Camp by Julie Desjardins.
Camp had figured that proper sportsmen would punt the ball away in due time, but Princeton men, unable to gain yards on their own, simply held the ball for the entire first half of the game against Yale, reasoning that if they could not score, they would not give their opponents a chance to either. Yale men responded in the second half by prolonging their possession of the ball too, until Camp punted the ball away, vowing not to allow, quote, the football rules to become a refuge for weaklings, end quote. In 1882, Camp invented the concept of downs.
We jumped a bit in chronology. When I talk about the scoring changes, I say that Camp is finished, he's graduated, but we're jumping back to a time when he's playing. He is an advocate in these rule meetings as a player, and he's saying, okay, let's get rid of the scrums. The team that gets tackled gets to maintain possession. He's just assuming like, well, obviously everyone's going to be a sporting gentleman about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not working, you're just going to kick it away out of the goodness of your heart, right?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of accounts of basketball games before the shot clock was instituted.
Mm.
How like you literally could just hold on to the ball and wait until, you know, the end of the half to, you know, drive and try to score a point or score 2 points, I guess, in basketball. But yeah, just a miserable watching experience and probably a miserable playing experience as well.
I think that manner of iteration is probably more common. Like, it's probably common in more sports than not, because mm-hmm. there's a very famous example of that's why the icing rule exists in hockey. And if you don't know what the icing rule is, so what was happening in this one infamous game was some team, I think it was the Boston Bruins, had a lead and they just thought, we just protect our lead by, as soon as we get the puck, we're just going to wire it down the ice.
Just launch it downfield or down ice.
And they did this for, God, it was 40 minutes or something. And so then the league had to come in and say, okay, now it is like the play will stop if you shoot the puck all the way down and we bring it back. Like, we had to make a rule because of your fucking annoying team. So this happens in so many sports.
Icing isn't activated, though, if you're down a man, right? You can just launch it.
Yes, and I believe the reason they added this is the opposite of your team is like making for terrible viewing. But in hockey, if you have a player in the box and the other team scores, that ends your penalty, right? The penalty mm-hmm. kill goes until somebody scores a goal. They had to add that rule because the Habs were so good in the, I think it was the 70s, that they scored so many goals in their power play that they were just too dominant, and they basically had to nerf them by saying, okay, one goal, and then the people are out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
This is now just hockey chat, but this happened with the Oilers in the 80s when Gretzky was playing for them, where Gretzky was so good with open ice that the Oilers would basically goad like their opposing team into taking a penalty. Like, I'm just going to like slash you and then you mm-hmm. punch me back. We each get a penalty, and now it's 4-on-4, which gives Gretzky and like the other skill right. players more room. And uh-huh. that's why they introduced the concept that still exists today of coincidental penalties, meaning if we, the refs, determine that you were just like doing fouls to each other, essentially, mm. we're just going to throw both you in the box, but it stays 5-on-5.
Right. What this also reminds me of a bit is like the World Cup, for like why they play the last game of the group stage all simultaneously, so that teams can't fuck around with like the goal differential and knowing that, hey, if we come to a scoreless draw, we can both get in.
Oh, yeah.
Because I want to say it was like Austria and West Germany did that one year in like the 80s. They knew that if they had a scoreless draw, they would both go through, you know, hey, German speaking countries. And they literally just like kicked it back and forth to each other for 90 minutes.
And it's amazing. We just named like so many examples of shitty sportsmanship. But for whatever reason, Camp is assuming that like, well, no. And what I will give it to him is that, so in this example of the game, so Princeton, they just hold the ball for an entire half. Mm-hmm. And then Yale starts doing it himself. But Camp is the one guy in the field who's like, no, I will punt the ball away. Like, watch me. So at least he put his money where his mouth is.
Yeah, very, very principled stance he took there.
Yeah, again, still ended up as a 0-0 tie. All that said, I remain personally a bit skeptical as to how much Camp invented as opposed to receive credit for advocating ideas that were already in the ether. Collins, for one thing, mentions that the term down was already established in rugby football. Regardless, I haven't seen this exact idea attributed to anyone else in particular, so we can't really form a counterfactual here. There were definitely opposing ideas, and some delegates proposed, well, what if we just go back to rugby scrums? But Camp does end up getting his way, and the rules get rewritten with the terrible phrasing characteristic of the era. So quoting from this original rule, "If on three consecutive fairs and downs, a team shall not have advanced the ball 5 yards or lost 10, they must give up the ball to the opposite side at the spot where the fourth down was made." End quote.
So if you lose 10 yards, you keep the ball?
Right? So I think if you lose 10 yards, it's an automatic turnover.
Oh, I see.
And if you gain 5, it's a first down. Now, they say fourth down, and I don't know if that includes like a turnover where it's given to you, because to be absolutely clear, by the way we understand football today, these rules are from 1882. They provide for 3 downs. The okay. fourth down was added to American football in 1912, right? That's 30 years later. So for whatever reason, they say you have 3 downs to do it, but the turnover is on the fourth down. They just did not know how to write at the time.
I guess it's my American chauvinism, but I always just assumed that Canadian football had taken away a down rather than American football having added one.
You know, I always kind of idly wondered it and just never looked it up.
Yeah, I guess I always assumed that like ours was the original and the Canadians, you know, they couldn't hack it for 4 whole downs. And so they took one away.
No, they fucked with 3 downs for 30 solid years. With these rules, there's a sudden need for exact measurement. So the colleges start to delineate their field along 5-yard increments, which gives the appearance much like a metal grill that you'd cook on, a gridiron, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
From there, the American game continued to iterate, with Walter Camp remaining a hugely influential figure within that process. But because he took the crucial step of writing so much of this down, he got to massively shape the folk narrative that emerged around American football. By remaining a member of the IFA, becoming a sort of de facto sports manager at Yale, and then their actual football coach, he established a presence within the culture of the sport that allowed him to position himself as an authority. In October of 1886, he published a piece entitled "The Game and Laws of American Football" in Outing magazine, the first of many articles in this vein. 1891 saw the publication of an entire book, American Football, in which he was free to wax on about the specialness of the American game and his hand in it. I want to read his words from the 1889 book, Walter, and you may be noticing he's publishing a lot of shit.
Mm-hmm.
This is a theme. I want to read his words from the 1889 book, Walter Camp's Book of College Sports, as an example of why we shouldn't take his word for it. After crediting the Canadians for introducing their version of rugby to Harvard, who in turn influenced Yale, Camp opines,
"Since 1876, the code has undergone many changes, the greater number being made necessary by the absolute lack of any existing football lore or tradition on American soil. The English game was one of traditions. What has been done can be done. What has not been done must be illegal, answered any question which was fully foreseen in their laws of the game."
Anyone who has listened this far into the series surely understands the idea of British football being fixed, rigid tradition is nonsense on the face of it. Since this time of his writing, association football has probably changed the least of all the codes, followed by rugby union in terms of changing the least. But in 1893, there was absolutely no reason to be saying this. To demonstrate my point, we're going to do a roundup of the way the non-association codes all spiraled away from each other in this period. As a reminder that this slate of games was not all that far apart yet, we can start with Camp's own books. In the same one we just read from, he talks about drop kicks for field goals and touching the ball down to earn a try at goal, like the exact same phrasing. He even says, quote, "With the exception of greater liberties in assisting a runner, it would not be a very difficult task to harmonize our game with the British," end quote. In his 1894 publication, Football Facts and Figures, he published a series of letters he received after soliciting opinions on the game from American college football alumni, many of whom label it American rugby, a term that might honestly have been less confusing if it stuck.
I like that alternate universe, American rugby.
Which is funny, because like rugby is like the one town in the entire UK that I don't think there is a place named after it in North America. When Rudolf Wirtz wrote to him from Melbourne, Australia, saying he'd been, quote, "out of touch with the rugby game or any modification of it," end quote, for a decade, but had been following Camp's, quote, "efforts to effect such improvement as the condition of the game suggested," end quote, and continued, quote, "The game played here is as near as can be the game played at Yale when Big Fulton was captain and the following year. Of course, you remember it. Certain unimportant modifications have been made with a view of making it a fast game. At present, I consider it a finer game from a spectator's point of view than the rugby game played at Yale in 1879 and 1880, end quote. So from this letter alone, I'm not 100% clear on what he means by out of touch, but all the specifics aside, what we can discern is it was still possible for someone to play the game at Yale this era and then go see the game being played in Melbourne after that and think, yeah, close enough.
Mm-hmm.
Cross-pollination, of course, continued apace. And this is from the introduction of how football began.
In America, Walter Camp studied the rule books of the different codes of football around the world. Melbourne's William Hammersley visited the Football Association in the 1880s to persuade them to try Australian rules. Albert Baskerville corresponded with American football administrators before leading his pioneering New Zealand rugby league team to Britain in 1907. During World War I, female Australian rules players in Perth could read about women's soccer players in Preston.
Right. We've actually talked quite a bit about all these games distinguishing themselves from the rugby style without talking much about how the rugby game itself grew in this period. I made a brief allusion to the consternation of the rugby football crowd when the Football Association organized some slightly shambolic internationals in 1870. As an example, one rugby-aligned school opined that the FA had no place in doing this as the rugby game was the parent code, was the word they used. Yeah, like, we are the code, we beget you. Which is kind of a funny position to take when rugby itself didn't have set standard rules yet.
Mm-hmm.
But those actions by the FA in organizing these internationals are one of the catalysts that actually shakes the rugby people out of their complacency in order to finally form the Rugby Football Union, or RFU, in January of 1871. However, the FA Cup would be rolled out later that same year, and it was clear by now that these two codes would never be reconciled. They were in direct competition for participants and attendees. Despite the late start in formation, the RFU actually had more member clubs than the FA by around 1874 or 75. That's 113 clubs to 78, to be precise. That lead would not hold by the end of the century, in part due to the RFU's refusal to offer a similar challenge cup to the FA Cup. Another factor holding the game back was its slowness to adapt, and this was made very evident in the game's schism in the years to come. We can't really trace the evolution of rugby union without understanding the emergence of rugby league, so let's try and address that. From early in, broadly speaking, football's evolution, compensation found its way into things. Even professionals aside, community games would have prizes up for grabs, like the Publican in 1849 offering up, quote, an excellent cheese of 40-pound weight.
An owl with a rooster's bits on either end of it.
Yeah, this guy offers up the excellent cheese of 40-pound weight to the winners of a game, quote, in order to revive the old sport of football, end quote, and also furnish the ball itself, which was another common practice.
Mm.
Other enterprising hosts might offer up a pig to the victors. However, that need for delineation between those who needed to be paid to play sports and the gentlemen who chose to play sports was held in high regard for a long time by the gatekeepers of civilized culture. We've spoken to this a little already, but I want to illustrate the starkness of this by quoting from an unbelievable asshole named Casper Whitney, which, asshole name for one thing.
Well, Casper's supposed to be friendly.
No, no, this is Casper with an A.
Oh, that is the evil way. Yeah.
Yeah. Caspar Whitney.
Yeah.
Hello, listener, and welcome to the Midreel ad. If you enjoy Canuck is a Slur, a podcast about Canadian culture, and you want to hear more of it more often, there is an option. The Canuck is a Slur Patreon. Signing up at any tier gets you access to Give Kelly Your Money. And joining an elevated tier gets you access to monthly bonus episodes. If that sounds good, you can sign up at www.patreon.com/Canuck is a Slur. And now, back to the episode.
So Caspar Whitney, he's an American writer and outdoorsman who would go on to be editor-in-chief of Outing magazine. In 1895, he wrote of what he saw as the threat of professionals ruining the clean nature of amateur sport. This word gets thrown around a lot, like keeping a sport clean, and by that mean unpaid.
Every time you mention Outing magazine, I imagine a magazine that is just a monthly list of celebrities who are gay.
Every time I read it, I'm like, is it my place to make this joke?
Like, I don't, yeah, it's like, that just seems like, well, that's not a nice magazine. Like,
oh, this is not like an Out and Proud magazine. This is like a shit list of putting the pink triangle on people. Oh,
yeah,
no.
Yeah.
So Whitney cites a definition of amateurship as defined in 1878 for the purposes of rowing in England. That definition of an amateur is, quote, an amateur oarsman or sculler may be an officer of Her Majesty's Army or Navy or civil service, a member of the liberal professions or of the universities or public schools, or of any established boat or rowing club not containing mechanics or professionals, and must not have competed in any competition for either a stake or money or entrance fee or with or against a professional for any prize, nor ever taught, pursued, or assisted in the pursuit of athletic exercise of any kind as a means of livelihood, nor have ever been employed in or about boats or in manual labor, nor be a mechanic, artisan, or laborer.
Now, based on the prizes we just discussed, when you said the word stakes, I have no idea if you are talking about a bit of money or a piece of beef.
I think it's both, because when he says with or against a professional for any prize, a stake is a prize.
That's true. Yeah, I guess that could include it. Okay.
We're going to come across an example like that's hardly an exaggeration. So in his writing, he also gives the example of the rules published shortly thereafter by the Henley Regatta, so boat race, right? And these don't really change the definition much other than adding the phrase or engaged in any menial duty to that last part of the list. While acknowledging that it may sound strange in the context of our American ideals of democracy, he believes there is an imperative to bring such rules to American sport.
Why there should be such constant strife to bring together in sport the two divergent elements of society that never by any chance meet elsewhere on even terms is quite incomprehensible, and it is altogether the sole cause of all our athletic woe. Unlike the quality of mercy which blesses him that gives and him that receives, this athletic philanthropy embarrasses both.
I feel like that's so evocative of that very particular strain of, I don't know, Christian guy, I guess, where it's like, no, let me differentiate between the good kind of giving and the bad kind of giving. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of conveniently the definition that suits what I like to do.
Mm-hmm.
He goes on to stress that certain education is needed to appreciate or even understand the true amateur definition, and continues.
It sounds quite as senseless and impracticable as the theory of that other utopian philanthropist who fondly expects the Negro, lifted suddenly out of generations of bondage, to fraternize and favorably compare with the race whose individuals have always been the refined and cultured members of the civilized world.
Oh.
There it is.
Yeah. I mean, just to think of the level of overt racism you get to have in this period of, like, this is what, 1895, I think? Yeah, 1895. I mean, you're just post-slavery. Everyone is still unbelievably racist. And you are, like, that level of vitriol is how much you also feel like the working class is also black people to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's so, yeah. Using examples of sports, which the reader is sort of presumed to already know have been absolutely ruined, he really goes off.
If this were not lesson enough for those who seem to believe that athletics, like love, according to popular report, levels all ranks, the present condition of track and field athletics and of football in England, in all of which their pet doctrine has been exploited, ought to be convincing proof of the utter impossibility of keeping amateur sport clean and throwing it open to the laboring, so-called, classes. For we are all laborers on this earth, laborers in our chosen professions or trades, laborers of different degrees of culture. According to the quality of refinement into which we are born or subsequently acquire.
I cannot make a jerking off motion forceful enough. This is what I tell people when people are like, what do you do for a job? I'm like, well, I'm sort of a laborer of culture.
Yeah, I'm a laborer of the mind, if you will, as an English teacher. I'm a laborer of sorts.
I'm not sure exactly how he meant it, but just the way it comes off to me of like, well, they say that love is the great equalizer. I wouldn't know.
Right. It like had little tinges of sort of like incel verbiage here where he's like, you know, kind of like showing that disdain for the concept of love.
Yeah. It's like while you're out there on Tinder, I'm out there on my grind. And by that, I mean thinking of culture. By that, I mean being a patron of the cinema or the theater.
This would be like a Roman statue Twitter account type thing.
Extremely. This is a Roman statue book, basically.
Mm-hmm.
He gives more examples how the low element has damned boxing and similarly been.
Wait, it's just funny that like boxing, the sport where you punch each other in the face.
Yeah.
It's been ruined.
Yeah, the most gentlemanly king sport of all, slugging each other in the face. Can you believe the working class wants in on this? So yeah, the low element has damned boxing, and it's similarly been ruining cycling and rowing, and football, in his opinion, is only saved, for now, by its relative lack of popularity.
If I can just interject here, I think it's so interesting, like, what it would have meant to be into sports, you know, kind of capital S, you're a sports guy. To have the same person concerned about boxing and cycling is very interesting, because I don't know how many people like that there are today.
Oh, man. Think of the opportunity for the biathlon of that. Like chess boxing, but it's cycle boxing.
Someone who's very into like the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia, but like they're also a big MMA fan. I just can't imagine that type of person.
I guess I shouldn't have thrown chess boxing in as a comparison, because cycling boxing sounds less ridiculous than chess boxing. So don't worry. He doesn't hate his social lessers. He doesn't even begrudge their interest in sports.
No one rejoices more than I at evidences of the lower classes turning their attention to sport. It's a magnificent spectacle of incalculable value to national manhood. And would it apply to the whole world? None is more democratic than I. I am more than willing to help my laboring brother of lesser refinement to do all I can for him in his worthy efforts to attain a sound mind and healthful body, give him advice, time, aid, and to encourage in every possible manner his endeavors to make more of a man of himself. But I do not care to dine or play football with him.
Yeah, listen, I don't hate my lessers. I just patronize them extremely. I just look down on them.
Well, I mean, this very much reminds me of the type of language that's used by, relatively speaking, progressive types in the northern states, you know, pre-Civil War, where, you know, they talk about abolition and how slavery is a great evil, but like, of course, you know, of course freed blacks wouldn't be equal to the white man.
Oh, yeah. Like, can we just have a kinder, gentler apartheid?
Right. It's kind of, it's the same sort of like, well, I mean, obviously they're not the same as us, but, you know.
Yeah, it's just the slavery is a little much.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that would, like the would that it were so simple, I think that's what it means. Like, would it apply to the whole
would
world?
Would that it were.
Yeah, exactly. As much as he sucks, Whitney goes on to write at length about his observations on university football on a visit to the UK while comparing it to the evolving style he was accustomed to at home and finds himself disappointed. This takes up quite a few pages, but in summary, he finds that it's much less skill-oriented. There is more focus on passing and less on tackling, but he also notes a lot of fumbled balls. The whole thing is slower, and in his view, the players are missing out on the interesting potential of ball play. The scrums are a mess, their tackles are high and ineffective. At one point, he describes regularly seeing players, quote, riding another's back in an unskillful effort to bring him down, riding another's back in an unskillful effort to bring him to earth, end quote. Which is just very funny to imagine.
Like, you very occasionally get something like that. If you've got, like, a big running back and, you know, like, a corner or someone is trying to take him down, but that is pretty comical.
Yeah.
Although now it's, like, obviously, like, the type of hits that they're, you know, trained to deliver are much more effective, even if there's a big size difference.
Yeah, like the way tackling will evolve is also interesting, but we'll kind of save that for later. His overall impression seems to be that any American football fan would see the rugby football game and, quote, feel he is watching an elementary game, concluding, quote, I never could shake off the feeling of looking on a game that had been neglected from infancy, end quote. Now, in the teeniest, tiniest bit of fairness, again, this is really a problem with the conventional rugby football at the time, is it is very slow to adapt and iterate, comparatively.
That reminds me just a bit about the early, like, ire caused among baseball fans by the allegations that, oh, this is just the British game of rounders. Because, like, rounders is, like, the simple game that kids might play on a playground. And they're like, no, our thing's different. It's not that.
Mm-hmm. Although the game of association football at the time is nearly forgotten in the United States and takes a firm backseat to rugby football in British universities, Whitney has a few words for it as well, having played it himself at school. He is dismayed that there has been little skillful innovation save for the advent of the header, although he thinks these foreign games would both benefit from more teamwork and coaching. Kiersey, he rates the chance of injury in rugby football at this time as markedly lower than American football, while he finds association football to be infinitely more dangerous.
Infinitely?
Yeah, his word, infinitely. One of the differences he notices with the British is their general lack of celebration and their fans' lack of cheering compared to Americans. But even within British sport, there was some division along these lines that emerged. In Barbarians, Gentlemen, and Players, a history of rugby football we saw earlier in this series, the authors describe this approach to amateur culture as, among other things, quote, self-restraint and, above all, the masking of enthusiasm in victory and disappointment in defeat, end quote. They quote a description of what's described as an Oxford-Cambridge match written in the 1930s. So this is a bit later, but...
Twickenham is a sobering frame for the bright battlescapes we put there. The man with a stiff upper lip is everywhere about it. So much is it a middle-class institution that the ebullient instincts are smothered at the gate. A spectator of Rugger in London has no kinship with the soccer fan. He retains his private life. Beyond the occasional shout, the discreet waving of a hat, he will not betray the agonies or ecstasies of strife. He will not sing nor eat hot dogs. His lips are guarded, though his heart beats strong. Twickenham is the last fortress of the Forsytes. And when the Welshman... and when the Welshmen come, they seem to feel the chill of it.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of... There's some kind of dog whistle going on in that last sentence.
Yeah, that makes it sound like any day, like, the Welshmen are gonna, like, surge across the border and burn your farm.
Yeah, the only way you can stop them is with your just rigid dignity.
He will not sing nor eat hot dogs. It would be a good bit of, like, a bio in, like, a social media or something.
Yeah.
I like seeing this... that this sort of holds true through history. Cause I know this is like one of the things that people laugh at Americans about is that like Americans are always like smiling and laughing and trying to, and having to be all like joyful. My students hate that about interacting with Americans is that, you know, if my students aren't actively smiling, the Americans are like, oh, well, what's wrong?
Mm.
And so like here seeing the same thing where it's like, well, the British are very, very, very serious about their sport. Whereas, you know, the Americans are just like going fucking crazy.
Yeah, I feel like it's a bit like, you know, the George Carlin joke about like anyone who drives slower than you is an asshole and everyone mm-hmm. who drives faster than you is a maniac.
Right.
I feel like this applies to basically everything. So everyone who shows more emotion than you is like an mm-hmm. annoying freak. And anyone who shows less emotion than you is a different kind of freak.
Same thing with like any sort of like pet interest that I have. It's like anyone who knows more about it than me is just like a fucking nerd who has no life. But anyone who knows less about it than me just hasn't put in the time that I have.
Yeah, exactly. But I also just trying to imagine exactly what is permitted from this, like the occasional shout, like just kind of staring stone faced at a game, and then going, whoop.
just one simple whoop.
Yeah.
And that'll do it. And like even that kind of gets you a little side eye from the person like down the bench from you. You have to really keep it under wraps. You get one whoop per game and you get five claps.
And like the discreet waving at a hat, it's kind of, it harkens back to that. I think that was in part one where like you're allowed to bend only at the wrists. So like,
right.
Are you waving your hat from the wrist or from the elbow? You know,
I can imagine that being a scene from like a movie, like spoofing this where it's like, and the crowd goes wild and it pans to the crowd and they're all just kind of like,
yeah,
a little gentle wave.
And I'm sure that that's going to transmit very well in audio.
I was waving my hand as if it, not even like I was holding a hat, like as if my hand is the hat, is what I was doing here.
Because this is actually even a bit later, right? This is a description written in the 30s, because most of the stuff we've been talking about is very Victorian. And this still kind of persists to this day. I mean, the probably polar opposites of this are, compare tennis and golf, right? Of the sort of mandated silence during mm-hmm. it, that you do not make noise. So that persists to this day, compared to the... From my perspective, sitting in the enlightened middle, like when they do the distractions from free throws in basketball,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, all right, this is getting a little silly.
Like the explicit goal is to annoy and yeah. distract the player.
But I mean, you see this with, not even to use like gridiron North American football as a comparison, but even just the way association football, like the whole point is to go nuts in the mm-hmm. crowd. That's the exact divide here. The spectator of Rugger in London has no kinship with the soccer fan. Everyone, I think, is very familiar with the football hooliganism, mm-hmm. with the what it's like to be in the stands at a soccer game. And it really is not that much change as you might think with a lot of rugby union spectators, especially. Like I remember my brother going, because he played for like the same club. He's the one who got me into it. They did a tour where they went and played and I think got destroyed in Ireland and Wales and stuff like that. And I think he went to a game at like the big stadium in Cardiff, and he was like, it was just wild where like somebody got a penalty kick and the entire stadium would just go silent. And then like the opposing team would kick the goal and everyone would be like, you know, like a polite clap for them to be like, like good kick kind of thing. But some of these things have not changed that much. So these ills of professionalism, they're made their way into the association game first and they had their own way through this. That's not a story for today. Jumping to the point, professionalism was legalized by the FA, so this is the association side, in 1885, but the RFU, the rugby side, the RFU was going to have none of that. The next year, the RFU president wrote of the effects he was seeing on the FA. So this is the rugby guy watching, this is the rugger guy watching the soccer culture and saying, quote, "Only 6 months after the legitimization of the bastard, we see two professional teams left to fight out the final cup tie. To what does this all end? Why this? Gentlemen who play football once a week as a pastime will find themselves no match for men who give up their whole time and abilities to it. How should they? One by one, as they find themselves outclassed, they will desert the game and leave the field to professionals." I don't know why I didn't do my snooty English voice.
So his complaint basically that like, oh, it's not fair that some people get to devote all of their time to this. And it ruins the game for those of us who are just playing it for fun.
It kind of depends maybe which person you ask, but this is one of the arguments, which is, as a gentleman, I only have time to play once a week. And I guess this is the time at which people are starting to realize that practice actually helps you. So when they're saying, well, if somebody has the ability, like I, a gentleman, I guess I can only play football once a week because I'm busy, I don't know, going to garden parties. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what these people are being kept busy with. But then the idea is, yeah, if this person gets paid, they're going to be able to be at the on the field all week. And then like then they're going to beat me. And that's not fair. Mm-hmm. So as an organization, the RFU declared no quarter for professionalism. They were ruthlessly effective in enforcing it to the point of investigating players for receiving wedding gifts from their teams. However, to make a long story short, this became untenable. Even the union leadership recognized that the rugby game was losing ground to the association game in popularity, due in no small part to the ability for the working class to get any shred of compensation at all for playing it. Mm-hmm. While it became clearer over time that rugby football was a sport for amateur gentlemen while association football had largely been subsumed by professionals, this hadn't quite cemented yet. Getting back once more to Tony Collins.
In late Victorian Britain, soccer and rugby were two parts of a single social phenomenon. Exactly the same social, cultural, and economic processes took place in each code. With the exception of a handful of clauses in their rulebooks, soccer and rugby were viewed by the press and the public as two variants of the same sport. Newspapers and magazines covered them both under the generic heading of football. Journalists, officials, and supporters referred to each version as football. And all players, regardless of whether they could legally handle the ball, were referred to as footballers. Only the aficionado cared about which set of rules were employed to engage the teams and to attract the public to the thrill of the spectacle.
I do find that kind of charming, the idea of like, hey, do you want to go see some football? Yeah, which kind? I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, it's like, we'll just see what they're playing today.
Yeah, I just kind of want to go and get drunk. I mean, I can kind of imagine that, like if somebody's like, do you want to watch bowling? And I mean, this is going to be I guess, an embarrassingly Canadian example, but if like, oh, 5-pin or 10-pin, I don't care. Let's just go watch bowling. Like,
how does 5-pin bowling work? Are they closer?
Fewer pins.
Are they closer together? Or are they like spread out?
They're just spread across like the head setup, like the five obvious pins you would think.
Okay.
And the ball is smaller. It was actually invented because like Canadians were too weak to throw a bowling ball, basically. Like, we need a light one. This one hurts. So it's a small ball that you just palm, like you don't have the finger holes and shit.
Oh, okay.
This concludes our series on 5-pin bowling. While the RFU bigwigs were not focused on the growth of the game and were happy to see that be actively inhibited by barring professionalism, not everyone was on board. Unlike with association football, rugby football's debate over professionalism came at a greater time of social upheaval, including the emboldening of working-class trade unions, particularly in the north of the country. In terms that will be completely unsurprising to people with a sense of class consciousness today, one newspaper wrote that these agitators for paid work ought to, quote, start a union of their own where they can quarrel amongst themselves, find employment for the many out of work, and indulge in strikes, trade unions, and a general disinclination for honest work so dear to the average North Country working man.
It sounds familiar.
Which is kind of funny because that is what has ended up happening with professionalization and also much later the unionization of players. It's like, well, yeah, now we do have lockouts and like programs to help players find jobs after they retire. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they got a lot of these things, but also Yes, unironically, yeah, they do. They should have a players' union.
Mm-hmm.
In a move that a lot of people would really do well to take notes on, working class solidarity and direct action worked. 21 RFU clubs, I've seen it 22, I think there's a weird technicality in how you count it, but 20-some RFU clubs resigned and reformed as the Northern Rugby Football Union, which didn't even start with a mandate of full professionalism. Even that was still frowned upon. The actual schism was more over what was called broken time payments. Have you heard of this?
I don't think so.
So these are literally just payments to compensate specifically for lost time at work in order to play. So not that we have to be paid to play the sport, but if I have to miss work, I get compensated for the work that I missed.
Mm. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, it's basically just a stopgap measure, mm-hmm. right? Or it's you might argue it's the bare minimum. And this is what people were like, this is what the RFU is going tooth and nail to prevent. One of the arguments against this, incredibly enough, was that this concession to the working class was discriminatory against, maybe you can guess.
I have no idea.
Discriminatory against the middle class.
Oh, right. The ones who always have a grievance of some kind.
Yeah. Barbarians, Gentlemen, and Players quotes a man identified as Arthur Budd, the old Cliftonian physician who became president of the RFU in 1888.
What's the AP? What's the guy's name?
Oh, that's very funny. The guy's name is Arthur Budd, but that's not what it means.
Okay.
I think they basically mean that, like, they're saying, like, person X and person Y.
Oh, okay.
Except AB is your first example person and CD is your next example person. That's my interpretation of it anyway. Yeah.
I see. If AB of the stock exchange were to ask for compensation for loss of time for a 2 days football tour, such compensation to be fixed on a scale commensurate with his earnings, the football community would denounce it as a scandal. AB, the stockbroker, has therefore to stop at his desk because he cannot afford to play. But CD, the working man, is to be allowed his outing and compensation for leaving his work, which under any other circumstances he could not afford to abandon.
Yeah, so basically what you have them saying here is really the person who is a stockbroker, if he actually earned what he was entitled to with this sort of broken time pay, everyone would say it's a scandal because of like how much money you make as a stockbroker.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but this person who barely makes any money at all mm-hmm. is allowed to leave work and be compensated for it, which.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's sort of a cousin of the type of thought that leads people to be like, oh, well, why is this eligible for food stamps? It's like, do you really think that they're reaping this much benefit from it?
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's this classic example of like this person who is 10 steps below me on this sort of socioeconomic ladder. Mm-hmm. If we let them go one rung up, it's like, well, now they're 5 rungs above me. Like, no, they're not.
Yeah.
We're throwing peanuts at these people and you're going like, but I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
There was a thing, this was, this level of inversion of who the entitled people are. Did you ever see that tweet where someone was saying like, you know, I really think this is about the working class versus the ruling class. But me, I would put Elon Musk in the working class and the local school board in the ruling class.
I do remember that.
I feel like this is just, it's the exact same brainworms. To compress a lot more history here, what started with broken time payments did eventually lead to full compensation schemes. This issue, as you surely know, happened in many sports in many countries, but in association football and most other cases, it didn't have this effect of actually splitting the sport. When it came to rugby football, though, it was no coincidence that the rebelling faction was all in the industrial north of England. Without getting into another world of complexity, there were very clear regional socioeconomic lines cutting through this issue. This is not to say that the Northern Union was exactly working class, more that these clubs were run by, as that same source frames it, members of the business and industrial middle class. So to put it in other terms, this isn't a union being so much run by these like public school elites, but they were local elites.
Mm-hmm.
And the meaningful difference there is not to give too much credit to rich people, but instead of being like Fauntleroy, fancy boy, old money, you are some sort of factory baron. You don't have as many of those old-timey gentry pretensions.
Mm-hmm.
So they're more pragmatic, ambitious, and they're just not, they don't have this pretension around who the sport is for.
Mm-hmm.
Competition, trophies, leagues, admissions, payments, all this is just fine by them. This also meant that changing the rules was completely on the table as long as it sold more tickets and got butts in seats.
Mm-hmm.
So this new Northern Rugby Football Union was formed in 1895, and after only 2 years, they began tweaking the scoring. By the 1906-1907 season, they had reduced the number of players, eliminated the throw-ins from the sidelines, eliminated most of the grappling, and instituted what is now sort of rugby league's iconic play the ball rule, where the tackle player just stands up and heels the ball back to their teammates, which maintains guaranteed possession. However, unlike what we described there in North America, the code doesn't actually introduce a tackle limit, which was initially 4, pretty much identical to American football, but they don't introduce that tackle limit until 1966. And then that was amended to the current number of 6 in 1972.
I keep mixing these up. Which version of rugby is that? League or union?
League is the one that splits off. And so the reason for the terminology, so the Northern Rugby Football Union later on renames himself to the Rugby League.
Mm-hmm.
This actually reflects the fact that a league, as it would have been understood or is still understood, is, okay, we are going to have a group of professional organizations. They're going to have like a fixed schedule against each other. They're going to compete for some sort of cup. This is all very structured. Like the idea of having a league was kind of antithetical to amateurism, where it was
right.
like, no, we'll just issue challenges to other clubs. That's
right.
my kind of understanding okay. of it, at least. Yeah. Because this different game, this game that changes over the course of the next 12 years, especially, because this group of people is a group of teams called the Rugby League, that kind of gets tacked onto the code, where the people playing under the old style are termed rugby union.
Hmm.
They probably could have found a better way to differentiate it. It is confusing. But because the offshoot league is about making money, and because the traditional rugby is not even traditional, but the existing rugby is, as everyone is realizing, like, it's kind of a slog. The scrums suck. The offside's confusing. This is actually not enjoyable for spectators.
Mm-hmm.
You have a different set of incentives than when you're just trying to get a bunch of, you know, gentlemen to agree on something. So they're like, well, let's just get all this fucking grappling out of here, and let's get this like absolute mess that happens when the ball goes down. Because even what would become the remaining group for rugby, like, they play around with this a lot in terms of like, well, what do you do when you get tackled? Do you have to push the ball away with your feet? Do you push it with your hands? Do you hold on to it? Do you do this? Do you do that? Nobody has like the perfect idea for it, which is mm-hmm. how we end up in part with these different codes that have different directions. So what they end up doing in with this group, this is already after both Canadian and American rugby players have played around with healing the ball, like pushing it back to their teammates. They're playing around with in the US, they fully instituted this snapback. So these people in Northern England go, okay, we're going to have you like roll the ball back to your teammates with your foot once you get up. They just don't seem to run into the same problem that the Americans did right away, which is, well, what if we just sit on the ball and never give it up? Yeah, they eventually introduce a tackle limit. It's just not for 60 years. Why, that's one of the defining features of rugby league now, is that you do kind of have downs. They're just not called that, and they don't start the play in the same way.
So when you get tackled, when there's 6 tackles, what happens then?
I believe you just hand it over. Like, I think it's just a turnover on downs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm not the most familiar with rugby league. I had to do a lot of brushing up on it. You can watch explainers on YouTube, but yeah, I think I'm going to say this. I'm going to edit out if it's wrong. I believe like you would still punt it for field position on your last down.
Okay, so just like American football.
Yeah, because basically people working at the same problems came up with often similar solutions. It's just that each of the offshoot codes, like Canadian, American, Australian League, even Gaelic football, came to a different combination of solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Similar issues over professionalism in Australia and New Zealand led to their own splits, and the league code spread as the code of professionals over the union code. So by the time these schisms are materializing in certain other countries, the people who are decided to be professionals can also just look to the rule changes that have already happened in the UK and say like, yeah, this seems to be the code for professionals. So we'll just take yours. Both these countries have their own stories of how these things developed. But in short, New Zealand became one of the world's most dominant countries in rugby union, while rugby league in Australia grew into its own beast, bigger than Australian rules, depending on who and where you are. That's just too granular for us to get into. Instead, we're going to turn to a very different split off from the established sporting hegemony, but this time across a much shorter body of water, the Irish Sea. But that is for part 7. All right, how are you feeling at the end of part 6?
This was good. I learned a few things in this episode that really made me sort of reconfigure American football in my mind and where some of these things came from.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the most information dense episode, but there was a lot of that information density that I'd been pushing back episode after episode. Eventually, it was like, we kind of just have to get down into it at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
But I think getting to see all these things happening in parallel, when I decided I wanted to do a series on Canadian football, I was like, I don't know how to do this without getting into the why. And the answer mm-hmm. to why is that, you know, seven different groups of people looked at these problems and saw seven different completely unique sets of solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount that these stories weave into each other and these people are constantly learning off each other, it's nearly impossible to tell the story in a vacuum. But thank you so much for joining us again, Tanner. Thank you so much for joining us, audience. Tanner, do you want to promote your ship?
I was confused because I was thinking about ships and I couldn't tell if you said ship or shit.
Do you want to promote your ship?
My ship is a ship called the Beyond the Breakers podcast. It is a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. If you like history and you like the sea, maritime stuff, you'd probably enjoy Beyond the Breakers. It's basically a shipwreck show, but we do cover other things occasionally. We do some bonus stuff where we get to spin off on some wider tangents. We'll discuss movies, books, things like that on those bonus episodes on Patreon. Yeah, check it out. We've got about 5 years of material that we've put out so far, plus the bonus episodes. So yeah, there's quite a bit to get into if you want to check out the show.
Yeah, and if you've been enjoying this, consider supporting Canuck as a Slur on Patreon. We have a tier as low as $2 a month. $5 a month gets you access to bonus content. As always, like and subscribe on YouTube, comment everywhere, follow us on our socials. Every little thing helps with the implacable wall of the algorithm. And this is a thing I often forget, but if you enjoy any clips or any episodes of this show, if you haven't done this yet, tell your friends, post them on Discord, post them on Reddit. People might not be aware of this, but in a lot of places, as somebody who makes stuff, I can't even post it on Reddit because if people find out you've posted your own shit, it's self-promotion. Mm-hmm. If you go and post it, you're just posting a thing you like. So
right.
In this case, I, of course, am the oppressed class here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, why is it that other people can talk about whatever they want on Reddit, but I can't talk about my podcast?
Well, it is kind of funny because one place I've run into difficulty with this is the hockey subreddit, right? The hockey subreddit, I don't know if they still do it, but I used to spend a lot of time on there, but there were people who would write these history things where just like somebody would just go write a 5,000 word text post and someone was like, wow, like, thank you for enlightening us to this history. This is amazing. But if I write a 5,000 word text, record it, put it on YouTube and then post it there, they're like, no self-promotion. So I don't know. It is a little bit of a double standard, but it's just a good reminder that there's many, many ways, even if you're not able to financially support the show, just even finding a place to post it, leaving a 5-star review or, you know what, let's be honest, 4-star review. all these things are greatly appreciated.
It also, I guess, depends on whether or not you're adhering to Podcast League or Podcast Union rules.
Yeah. So until next time, just remember the podcast rules here. So if you are enjoying this show per episode, you get one shout. You can wave your hat from the wrist discreetly. This is a really good rule for life. If you're sitting on the bus listening to this thing and you're enjoying it or you're hating it, try not to betray the agonies or ecstasies because people on the bus will think you're weird.
If you're enjoying it, just one gentlemanly whoop and that should be sufficient.
Yeah, I start out making fun of this, but that is probably good rules for listening on the bus. Most importantly, if you are listening to this in a timely manner, the Grey Cup is Sunday, November 16th. So I have pitched this before, but I encourage everyone to give it a shout. I believe it is going to be broadcast on, I should have looked this up, on like an American TV channel. It'll be in the post. It'll be in the description. Reach out if you want to. I feel like I can say this on a small podcast. Just pirate it. There's ways to stream it. We're going to try to have a watch party for the Grey Cup in the Canuck as a Slur Discord. Yeah, check the information in the description. I will put all of the details on like what time the game starts. It's afternoon, maybe like 6 p.m. Eastern time. Don't take my word for it. Yeah, I think it'll be really fun. So anyway, until next time, do not sing. Do not eat hot dogs.
Canuck is a Slur is an independent collaborative effort to present a critical, progressive perspective on Canadian history and culture.
Drop them.
To make consistent, high-quality content, we need your support.
Let's tangle.
Head on over to patreon.com/Canuck is a Slur to sign up.
Beauty.
If you're still on the fence, well, here's the sales pitch. Patrons at the good old Canadian boy level unlock expanded access to our Discord server, including sneak peeks at upcoming episodes.
Let's go!
Patrons at the good old Ontario boy level will also get into our archive of bonus content, which includes an extra episode every month. Patrons at the good old Kingston boy level get to commission a free piece of bad art every month as well, in addition to further special Discord privileges.
Oh, how she loves the Stanley Cup. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go! Listen to what I say. Play that game the Canadian way. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go!
We'd love for you to come and follow us on our various socials, which you can find linked in the episode description. You can also see any further links for our guests and co-hosts there as well. The creators of this work would like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples across the continent that had their homes stolen, land broken up by arbitrary borders, cultures suppressed, languages banned, children kidnapped, and who were subjected to many other forms of colonial violence. We also acknowledge the many treaties broken and still unceded territories across Turtle Island. Thanks for listening. Eat the rich and happy trails to you.
While the RFU Big Bigs were... Wow. The Big Bigs.